May it please the Court, Your Honors, Dana Nelson on behalf of Marcus Ruffin. I'd like to reserve 3 minutes, please.
Very well.
And also I'd like to apologize to the Court and Counsel for being late. I was stuck in that horrible traffic this morning.
We understand.
Thank you. There are three issues in this case, the reasonable doubt instruction, prosecutorial misconduct, and whether Mr. Ruffin was denied his right to present a defense. I don't really have anything to add as to what Ms. Swift just said about the reasonable doubt instruction, and so I'd like to rest on the briefing with respect to that issue and concentrate on the other issues. Turning to the prosecutorial misconduct issue, on direct examination of Jacob Mommer, the prosecutor elicited that Mommer had been accused of the exact same crimes for which Ruffin was on trial, and that the jury convicted him as a quote-unquote accomplice. The prosecutor elicited that an accomplice means somebody who helps somebody, aids and abets, and or helps out in the crime. Now, the obvious import of these questions was to make Mommer out to be somehow less culpable than Ruffin. And there are several problems with this. There are several reasons why this constitutes misconduct. First of all, Your Honor, why the jury convicted Mommer in that other trial was sheer speculation. The jury instructions do not allow us to, or the court to deduce, what theory the jury relied on. They simply required the jury to find that Mr. Mommer or an accomplice did the acts that constituted the charged offenses. And also, there were several reasons that the jury could have doubted that Mr. Mommer was the principal in the case. For instance, he did not testify. The state didn't present the identity of the other participant because it didn't know who that was at the time. Moreover, the state's main witness, Rose, didn't see the shooting of Ashton Reyes. So his testimony didn't add anything to whether Mommer was convicted as a principal or as an accomplice. Now, Your Honors, that may have been the state's theory at trial, but again, the jury was free to disregard that. So it was sheer.
What do you think that conveyed to the jury that was harmful to Mr. Ruffin?
Your Honor, I think that it amounted to vouching by the prosecutor by saying that one jury had already found that Mommer was less culpable in that it convicted him as an accomplice. The prosecutor was. Was suggesting that he was the less culpable participant of the two, which likely caused jurors to put more credibility on his testimony than it otherwise would. It also injected facts into the case for which there was no evidence. It's basically akin to that infamous question, when did you stop beating your wife? It's assuming facts not in evidence. And it's misconduct for a prosecutor to suggest that there's evidence out there not produced at the trial that supports the witness's testimony. And that's, in fact, what the prosecutor was doing here. And finally, it was also misconduct because what one jury decided in one particular case wasn't relevant to what was before this jury. It was this jury's job to decide the facts as presented to them.
Did the state use any of this testimony during this closing argument?
Your Honor, I can't recall that. I know that in our briefing we point out that every time that he mentioned that Mommer was convicted of as an accomplice. But, Your Honor, logically the prosecutor would not ask these questions if it didn't have a particular import. Now, I know that logically accomplice liability is the same as principal liability, but from a layperson's perspective and from a moral perspective, a juror might not necessarily see it that way and think that the person who pulled the gun and did the shooting is the more culpable one. So there was definitely a reason for these questions. And whether the prosecutor reiterated that in closing, I don't think matters because the point was already made. And the reason why this was highly prejudicial in this case is because credibility was key. Mommer said Ruffin was the one who did the shooting. Ruffin said he wasn't there. There was also some evidence presented, Your Honors, from which a jury could have found that there were two shooters, one who shot Rose and left, and then one who shot Reyes after Rose left. And I base that on Susan Usmail's testimony when she testified that she looked back and she saw a man with his arm outstretched toward the car in the subway parking lot, saw a flash, heard a shot, saw the man run up the hill where he was met by another individual. Now, Ruffin testified that when he, Mommer testified that when he got back to the car, Ruffin was already there. So from the combination of this testimony, it's possible the jury could have had a doubt about Ruffin's complicity in at least the murder. And with the prosecutor vouching that one jury had already found that Mommer was merely an accomplice, the jury likely resolved any doubt against Ruffin in this case.
Was vouching the subject of an objection by the defense below?
Your Honor, defense counsel did not say that, but he did say legal conclusion and he did say relevance, both of which were applicable in this case, because what the jury found in one case wasn't relevant. So it should have been sustained on that basis, and the court should have recognized that there was a problem with this testimony. Turning to the second issue, the right to present a defense. Specifically, Ruffin argues that he should have been allowed to elicit his prior statement to defense counsel that he had an alibi to rebut the state's allegation of recent fabrication. And I'd like to respond to one thing the state said in its response brief. And that was basically the state conceded that had the prosecutor asked Ruffin, well, you never told your attorney prior to this trial that you had an alibi, that Ruffin would have been entitled to elicit that prior consistent statement. And we would ask this, or we would urge this court that the 801D12 should not be interpreted so narrowly. The issue here was alibi and whether this defense was just made up at the last minute. The prosecutor's cross-examination was clearly geared towards making that point, and it was left an unfair impression on the jury because, in fact, according to defense counsel, Ruffin had mentioned that he had an alibi prior to the last minute before the state rested its case. So, Your Honors, I'll save the remaining time for my rebuttal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. Dennis McCurdy for the State of Washington, the respondent in this case. I primarily want to deal with the evidence about whether the defense was prevented from putting on a defense, but I did want to just address one moment, Judge Cox, your question about whether there was an objection made on the misconduct claim. There was an objection, but it wasn't the objection to what the defense says it was. Here's the question that was asked. Were you convicted of being an accomplice to murder in the first degree and assault in the second degree? Answer, yes. No objection. Question, do you know what an accomplice is? Answer, yes. Question, what is it? That's when the objection comes in. Defense counsel never raises an objection to the witness testifying, I was convicted of murder as an accomplice. Was never raised as vouching, was never objected to at all. And the only other thing I'm going to say about that, unless this court has other questions, is the defendant, or he has personal knowledge. It's simply an evidentiary issue.
He has personal knowledge of what?
If he was at his own trial. He knows what the theories of the case
right.
was. He's what was
does,
intended
does
to show
know
what his role was, that he wasn't the shooter.
But does he know what the jury found?
He knows the jury found him guilty of murder. He knows the theory of the case was that he was
he
the person
know
in the back
that
seat.
The jury found him guilty of being an accomplice. What was the question that the jury was asked?
I think that's a question of
what was the question that the jury was asked?
I know what the instruction said,
right.
And I agree with you.
It said accomplice or principal. It doesn't matter.
Right.
So and that was the theory. That might have been the theory, but the question that was presented to the jury was whether it was an accomplice or a principal. And you have no idea, nor does this witness, which one of those the jury concluded.
Well, in that case, then isn't that the defense objection? Because
I'm not arguing with you right now about whether or not the defense objected to it. What I'm asking you right now is whether or not this testimony was improper.
Because I believe that a trial court could rule, if there had been an objection, says, well, you don't know. I believe there's a good argument that says, yes, he does, because he does know the theory of the case, that he was never.
He knows the theory of the case.
Correct.
That's what he knows.
Correct.
He doesn't know whether the jury bought that theory or not.
Well, I think, again, that's to me it's a question of fact, because he does know whether there was evidence presented that he was the
shooter. If he had been asked, do you know what the state's theory was at trial, he could have answered that question, because he sat there and he heard it.
Absolutely.
But he wasn't in the jury room.
Absolutely.
And he doesn't know what the jury decided.
And, Your Honor, I know your background. That's great cross-examination of that witness. So if a court did allow it to come in, cross-examination would be, you don't exactly know what the jury did, or you object to its admission at all under 403, saying it's too prejudicial or he doesn't have direct knowledge, either one.
But, I'm not getting at that issue, so, whether or not if there was an objection. There wasn't an objection. Let's assume that.
Okay.
Okay. And the question is whether it was improper and whether or not it's flagrant and ill intention. I mean, that's the issue that we're looking at.
Okay. Well, I don't see, first of all, there was never any vouching that was done. The jury knew he was convicted of murder in the first degree. I don't see how it the jury is supposed to find him more credible because he's essentially arguing, or the state's presenting the same evidence. He was in the back seat. He wasn't the shooter. There's no evidence he was the shooter.
So you're essentially saying that even if we assume there was misconduct by virtue of this, that there is no demonstrable prejudice, the second prong?
Absolutely. Okay. But I also think you would have to find, to even find it's misconduct, you'd have to really find that the prosecutor had no argument whatsoever, no legal basis to ask that question, and that they intentionally did so for a purpose of vouching. Because otherwise, to me, it is just an evidentiary matter and an evidentiary objection. And I think there's reasonable minds could, I think we're both reasonable, reasonable minds could differ on that, but that doesn't make it misconduct unless you find somehow that this was, that there was some sort of evil intent involved in this.
Can we hear about the hearsay issue?
Yes. And that's primarily what I wanted to talk about most. But first, I usually don't talk much about the facts of the case, more the law, but I do think it's important to note in this case, there were two types of evidence that tied the defendant to this murder. Phone records that showed he was using a number that just had a prefix of 229, and the identification by Momer, and somewhat tangentially by the person Marcus Niebel, and I don't know if this court remembers, but their testimony came up in the sense Momar and Niebel both testified that they were smoking pot together with a gentleman right before the police arrested Momar. And the defense at 11 RP89 tried to indicate that that was right the day before he was arrested, which was would have been February 13th. And the testimony is that Momar told Niebel he's the guy that did something bad, doesn't specify what it is, but somebody died. Month into trial, two alibi witnesses are disclosed one day before the state's going to arrest, Monica King and Danielle Phillips. One is the alibi, Danielle Phillips is supposed to testify, I was with the defendant on February 13th and 14th, and King was going to testify, I was with the defendant at the time of the shooting. Both of them, I might add, testified that they used a number which was 455 to contact the defendant in November and December before the murder. Ultimately, what comes out is we actually have the phone records. That phone did not actually exist during those time periods. So they were caught in a bold-faced lie. What King testifies to, she says, I was with the defendant. She says, we never talked about it. There's no issue about timing that's brought up by the state. She says, I didn't come forward to anybody. I never told anybody, not the defense attorney, nobody, until trial. Because I was so emotional, I didn't want to get involved. She also testifies the defendant knew that. Then Ruffin gets up and testifies to the same thing, says, you know, we didn't talk about it, and, excuse me, the reason we didn't is because I know her emotional state, she would have been all upset by that. And then the defense tries to get into conversations that he had with his client.
With his lawyer?
With his, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. And It is hearsay. It doesn't fall under 801 because, first of all, if you look at King, it has nothing to do with King because it's not a statement of her. She never made a prior consistent or inconsistent statement. She never made a prior statement, period. The same thing with Ruffin. If we had gone and said, well, you never told your attorney that, or if there's some recent...
Wasn't the thrust of the cross-examination, though, that you just created this alibi defense 6 days ago?
Well, I think the facts themselves suggest that, because they both...
I mean, I'm asking, wasn't the thrust of the conversation, though, that you recently created this defense of alibi?
You mean the thrust of cross?
The thrust of cross, yeah.
No, but it was his conversation. What we talked about, and the prosecutor even says, I was very specific. All that she did was cross-examine him about his conversations with her and whether they discussed alibis, not indicating, oh, you just did this, because they both testify, she was an alibi way back when. They testify, we didn't talk about it, but they had 100 or so conversations. And the prosecutor says, so you never talked about that. Yes, they both agree with that. There wasn't anything like the defense cites McWilliams where the co-defendant enters a plea and the defense argues that plea is what was the factor that showed you had the motivation to lie. That didn't occur. There's nothing you can point to that says the state said something, there's something happened that you created this that created this motive to lie, some timing mechanism. And that's what's required under 801. There has to be something, some motivation that didn't exist before that event. Well, what is that event? We don't have that. They simply sat on this. They both agreed. The defendant and defense, or not defense counsel, the defendant and King both agreed. They sat on this. They didn't discuss it. So there's it doesn't fall under 801. It also isn't a constitutional.
You're suggesting that even if there is an inference of recent fabrication, that the subject that was fabricated, the alibi defense, there was a motive. There's that entire sequence of events. There had always been a motive for him to come up with that fabrication. There was no recent motive or change. It's easy to come up with that.
That's correct. And as I said, this applies to Ruffin because King doesn't make any prior statements. So unless right. There's any other questions, I'd ask this court to affirm.
Okay, thank you.
Just a few points here, Your Honors. Returning to the right to present a defense, the state is really reading the prior inconsistent statement rule very narrowly. The entire point of the cross-examination was, this is all new. You never said anything about this before. You never told King to go to your attorney. The fact that Mr. Ruffin previously told his attorney about an alibi obviously would have made his alibi defense more believable in the eyes of the jury, because it would have rebutted the prosecutor's argument that he just made this whole thing up.
So your point is essentially that the exclusion of the purported conversation between counsel and client should have been admitted.
The fact that he brought it up to his attorney before.
The fact, or did you want an actual conversation, the testimony?
Your Honor, initially all defense counsel wanted to ask was that, did you ever bring this up to me? And defense counsel was precluded from even asking that limited question. And I think the case cited in our briefing in the reply on the last page talks about how an accused statement to his attorney testifying about that does not open up the whole can of worms.
So it's your view that that question could have been asked and answered and there would not have been an opportunity for the prosecution to pursue that?
No, Your Honor. The prosecutor could have asked the defendant about the circumstances of making that statement. And had the court allowed the investigator to testify to overhearing this statement, then the prosecutor would have been able to inquire about the circumstances of that statement. And the prosecutor could have asked the defendant about his motivation at the time he made that statement.
So, the defendant waived his attorney-client privilege wouldn't the state have been entitled to interview defense counsel and ask things like, well, what else did he tell you? I mean, how could a trial court ever really administer that kind of a situation?
Your Honor, I was looking at that last night, and I reread that case. It's State v. Vandenberg, and it talks about a limited waiver. And the court there, it said that the fact that the defendant mentions a conversation, that he had a conversation with his attorney about a certain topic, does not open up the whole gambit. And the court on page 186 of that case said, the client's offer of his own testimony in the case at large is not a waiver for the purpose either of cross-examining him to the communications or of calling the attorney to prove them. Otherwise, the privilege of consultation would be exercised only at the penalty of closing the client's own mouth on the stand. And so that's where our backup position would have been at the very least. Mr. Ruffin should have been allowed to say that he previously told defense counsel about an alibi. And defense counsel had a good faith basis for the question, so that should have been allowed. I see I'm almost out of time, so thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, counsel.